Okay. I think, you know, I mean, in many ways, Kate's presentation on the Edelman Trust Barometer and the results of the 2020 study, and then the really exciting subsequent study that they've done over the summer, I think is incredibly interesting. And you said three things that present the path forward. And I guess for me, I'm sick of talking about the problem. I want to know what can be done about it and who's going to do it, I guess. And you said three things, Kate, that I want to sort of get other people's reactions to. You said the path forward is for people to do the right thing. So there's that ethical piece. And then there's this piece about partnership. And then there's the thirst for leadership. So those sort of three dimensions. Can we talk, each of you, about partnerships, about where the leadership is going to come from? If our politics is as broken as Peter has summarised eloquently, I think, making everybody really depressed, I know. You know, Michael, maybe starting with you, those three aspects, doing the right thing, partnership, and leadership, where's it going to come from?
Like all these sort of things, I've got to come at it as an economist, I suppose. And what strikes me from an economics perspective, the kind of common linkage here that then feeds into all these things is really income. The reality is, the World Bank, they did this very interesting study a little while ago, and it basically looked at income growth around the world. And what it showed was that pretty much every group had gone ahead. Except for that group, they're in what was essentially the 75th to 95th percentile on the income distribution. Who sits in that group? Well, it's the middle income populations of the advanced economies. So you've got a big group there who feel like they haven't actually really participated or seen the benefits of all the sort of things that economists like me talk about, reforms, productivity, all the rest of it. They can't see it. And so what you actually get then is a whole group of people who feel they're being left behind. It's an environment ripe for populism. And before you know it, you're talking about things like Brexit and President Trump and the like. And that then, I think, just feeds into these whole questions about trust, because you can track the decline in trust, as we've heard, amongst politics around the world in particular. It's just at levels that are low everywhere. And I think a lot of it just comes back to this sort of degree of disappointment. That's kind of easy to identify the problem, I suppose, in some ways. Solution, well, that's much harder.
Well, so might the solution lie in your profession?
We're all very happy to give advice all the time, but I don't need to get re-elected, so.
Oh, I meant the economics discipline, but we'll come back to that. Diane, can I ask you, where do you think the partnership, the leadership's going to come from?
Well, you know, I'm a business person, so I'll always look to what is it that's going to motivate business people. So Michael talked about income being the important motivator and how important it is to spread economic development and income more evenly. But I think a business will always look to where is profit going to come from and how are they going to get that return. And if you think that in today's networked, globalised world that you can be your own little silo company and operate in the way you have in the past and that you're going to continue to have success, then you are a lunatic. And you see it like Wesfarmers. I talked a little bit about Wesfarmers' storied history and what great returns it's generated to its shareholders over the period that it's been listed. And that was founded on an autonomous division model, and it was very much around Bunnings did its thing and Kmart did its thing and chemicals and fertilisers did their thing. Now it's become very clear that across the group we've got an industrial line and we've got the retail line, and they actually have to collaborate and cooperate together. You know the old story, oh, I don't have to be the fastest runner in the jungle, I just have to outrun the slowest other gazelle. Well, that's rubbish now, because it's the slowest gazelle that creates the networked problem for us. And it might be on cybersecurity, which I think is sort of obvious, but it's also around things like Amazon. So the Australian business community has to get together to own its customers and provide its customers with globally competitive, world-class services. So supply chains have got to come together with other outsourced services, with the landlords, and then the retailers at the end of it. Otherwise, we will lose the profit and the tax dollar that comes with that part of our economic activity to offshore. And no amount of thin capitalisation rules and BEPS is ever going to save us. So I see partnerships are an absolute imperative for us to retain our corporate returns, which is the thing that gives us the ability to pay the incomes.
Peter, someone has asked here, given the lack of political leadership, how relevant is government in charting a way through this? So I guess the questioner is sort of implying that the leadership won't come from politics or government.
Yeah, there's almost no chance that leadership will come from politics at the moment.
So where's it going to come from?
Yeah, well, it's definitely not coming from politics. I mean, let me just very quickly say why. The two parties have become so narrow cast in their memberships. Who goes into politics is therefore incredibly narrow cast as well. The trade union movement used to be broad, now it's narrow. Labor still only gets its personnel from there, so they get an incredibly narrow representation of working class Australia, whereas once it was broad. The Liberal Party used to get people genuinely from business come in. They don't do that anymore, very rarely. Generally, the only ones that do are people who are unsuccessful in business, so they decide to go into politics instead. If they have anyone that does come from business...
Except for Craig Laundy, in fairness.
Well, there are exceptions to every rule, but he's gone now too,
yes,
because he couldn't put up with it for more than two terms. So those that do come from business, nothing against corporate affairs, but they tend to have already been in corporate affairs, trading off their political contacts, then they go into politics and they say, aren't I a great business person, but they've never been at the P&L end of the business. So the people in politics are no good, when it comes to being able to show leadership at least. And then that's made worse by a media that is poll-driven, gotcha-driven, social media, 24-hour news cycle. So the media makes it worse. And then, frankly, the voters make it worse as well because people are busy in the rest of their lives. They pay scant attention. They think they know more than they do because we now have puddle-deep knowledge across a whole array of things, but it is puddle-deep. So no leadership's coming from politics.
Excellent.
The exception to the rule would be the only way of thinking glass half full, in my view, which is that, yes, you occasionally get an individual who goes into politics that is able to buck the trend. Once upon a time, there were more of them with less problems to buck, whereas now there are fewer of them and more systemic problems in the system to make them succeed. But every now and again, one of them might accidentally become leader and surprisingly do well despite the system being geared completely against them. At that moment, once every, 50 years, we'll have leadership.
Maybe right, you and I should go into politics.
Just eat some of your dessert while you contemplate you. That. Jared, where's the leadership going to come from? Or who's going to start catalysing these partnerships?
So
it's not coming from politics. We know that.
I love that I'm following Peter on that one. So one of the interesting things for me was when we did our disadvantage work last year, was the number of examples of where really local collective leadership is actually delivering solutions. And it seems to come about, not necessarily by thinking about who would be, the sectors or the groups, but thinking about who's got common interests and will around an issue. And so I saw some, I was frankly surprised as we went around the country doing these events, how many times business people would come up to me and tell me about an employment initiative that they were running out in their local community with NGOs, with others in the space. So it seems like we actually, at the community level, we know how to do this stuff.
Mm. But and we've seen that again in the bushfire response, haven't we? Yeah. We've seen people's self-organising capacity. Is it something about centralisation? And that actually localism is what we're going to see a bit more of. And, I mean, you alluded to some of that, Kate. What do you think?
I think that trust, it's interesting. So we've been doing trust for 20 years. And 20 years ago, when we looked at trust, it was the CEOs and the business leaders and the government leaders that were the most trusted. And that completely inversed in the last 10 years. Mm. So now the most trusted people is the person like yourself. It's that which is local to you, the people that you're surrounded with, it's your local government, it is your employer, as I said. So that's where you feel that trust level, and it's not in the federal level leaders or the big kind of global CEOs you see out there. It's really going to come from those relationships that you have locally.
Diane?
Yeah, that's a really interesting dynamic, isn't it, that people in organisations actually do trust the leadership in their organisation. Mm-hmm. They trust their own CEO. but they don't trust all the other CEOs. And I remember, you know, back in the last century when I was at Westpac, I saw that same phenomenon around life insurance salesmen and car salesmen. You know, it's like we don't trust them as a class, but my one is absolutely great. Yeah. So it's a bit sad that as business leaders we're now in that same dynamic.
I think there'd be a lot of people in the public sector who'd reflect on that too, right? I trust the service that I'm interacting with, but I don't trust the system as a whole. So that kind of human element is really interesting. I mean, one of the really interesting things over the summer, I think, has been, because I can never, like you, Diane, I always have to say something about the Federation, you know, has been interesting how, for the first time in a really long time, I think, people have been looking at subnational governments and going, oh, they kept kind of doing their job. And that's the first time I can think about that happening in the last little while. Do you think that's right?
Me?
Oh, either of you, down that end. You're both looking at me.
I thought you were asking my political guy to have a real opinion on it.
Well, you've got a regional... I mean, you've got a federated perspective, both of you, because you spent a lot of time in Western Australia. And, you know, and I think that's really worth kind of hearing. Did that interest you?
Well, look, in Western Australia... we've got the GST sorted out, but we still have this amazing barrier, and it really does make West Australians feel, and I know I felt the same thing in Queensland when I was here, that there really isn't much focus from Canberra at all on West Australian issues. So during the bushfire crisis, the highway was cut at the border. It got barely any coverage. No one had a clue that Western Australia was, as we've always felt, on our own. And we actually did get a lot of media and coverage around that. So I know you like to talk about the Federation. I think the Federation's broken. I think the Federation has the ability to add a lot of value to the nation, because whenever you look at modelling around the Federation working well, it will always come out as a net benefit. But at the moment, it's just another casualty of the lost decade of...
stasis and incapacity.
Yes, at the moment.
Yes.
So
Peter?
I think eventually, and it started to happen a little bit, eventually federal politicians will realise that a re-embrace of federalism is actually also politically good for them, because then they can discharge responsibilities more appropriately back to the states, which they've been slowly but surely usurping over the decades.
And discovering themselves incapable of delivering.
Exactly, and therefore remove themselves from political accountability to some extent for what happens or doesn't happen in those spheres of you know, in those areas of policy responsibility. I just wanted to very quickly say this. Even though I'm clearly a pessimist on political leadership, where I think there is some hope is that the modern version of good political leadership is just political leaders that will get out of the way of where leadership is being able to be shown elsewhere across society.
Yeah, I think that's
right. And there is some sense that some political leaders get that. And that's partly maybe from their pre-parliamentary careers, partly because they can see it firsthand when they go through consultation. But that, to me, is kind of the modern version of political leadership. Just don't stuff it up for other people.
There's a question here about Matt Canavan that I'm going to hold to the end. Who would like to ask a question from the floor? Oh, Fabrizio.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Anne. And that's a question for the panel, I guess. I'm Fabrizio Carmignani from the Griffith Business School. One of the things that worries me the most about Australia is that in terms of innovation, entrepreneurship, research and development, we are falling behind the global leaders and the regional leaders. And that worries me because at the end of the day, in the long term, economic growth is a matter of innovation. And if we plot economic growth since the 60s in Australia, well, it's on a declining trend. And that's not a statistical issue, it's just what the data say. So we need to change the trend. And without innovation and entrepreneurship and investment in new ideas, I think that's not going to happen. So I was wondering if you see any way in which we can, as a community, so public sector, private sector, universities, work together in order to change this trend.
I think that's one for you, Michael. You're looking for productivity.
Yep, absolutely, and that's got to be part of the story. But I think there's a couple of things that are interesting here. And I mean, these numbers are a year or two old, so they might have changed a little bit. But if you look at the top 10 companies in Australia, you know, the most recent addition to that list was Woolworths in 1920. If you look at the top 10 companies in the US, five or six of them out of that top 10 have been there since 1980, or appeared since 1980. So it's the obvious ones like Microsoft and so on are in that list. But it kind of highlights the problem here and that kind of lack of innovation. And we're always happy to talk about it and have innovation statements and all the rest of it, but nothing seems to happen. And I think part of the fundamental problem here is that we're actually quite good at coming up with the ideas. It's then kind of translating those ideas into commercial reality where we fall down, partly because there aren't the sort of funding markets in Australia to do it. But, you know, venture capital is only a very small part of what's available from that side of things here compared to the US, for example. Partly I think it's a lack of risk appetite. You know, if it's not going to be something that's going to make money next month, then we're not really interested. And we all know the problem here. For every 10 you pick, nine are not going to do anything. But we don't want to take that risk, and so not surprisingly, it just disappears offshore when we see a lot of the benefits go in that same direction.
Yeah, lack of policy certainty can't help either. Jared, did you want to comment on that?
So there's really three areas where I think we've got to do a lot better on this. The first is with the community. So both of our community and company pulse show that there's a real level of indifference around new technology and innovation, that people don't really see it as being relevant to their lives. So I think we need to do that. And I think we saw, Turnbull was very passionate about innovation and had an innovation agenda, but no one else seemed to get that excited about it. So I think you've got to start there. You do have to have, secondly, a set of policies and programs and actually commit to that. And I think we've been a bit hesitant in Australia, particularly around kind of, mission-led programs that we feel like, we're the free market, we can't have, government with these massive R&D programs, but we need a consistent...
And maybe it's also the surplus fetish.
Mm. Yeah, we need a consistent program. And then thirdly, it comes down to collaboration. And I was in California for some of the break and just speaking to people at universities there who are doing fantastic work with Silicon Valley. I don't meet as many people in Australian universities who are embedded, part-time or almost full-time in big companies and, bringing that cross-fertilisation.
Yeah. It's funny how the federal government doesn't seem to kind of seize the fact that it controls those incentives and policy settings for higher education, policy and funding. That, there really would be an awful lot they could do to incentivise that behaviour. But have we focused too much on tech and startups and not enough on... Glenn Stevens' 100,000 things you could be doing better every day. I often wonder if we're too focused on tech and not enough on social innovation and the potential for other kinds of innovations and improvements.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good comment because we talked about partnerships before, and partnering in different ways is actually a form of innovation. Yep. When you look at what's the largest innovation lever that business could pull, it's often shown to be that partnering thing. And I went to Israel a couple of years on the trot to have a look at the innovation ecosystem there, and it was absolutely fascinating because, it's a much smaller nation than we are. And because of the geopolitical environment in which they live, which they describe as challenging, they have a tendency to stand in that tiny little nation and they're looking out, to make sure someone's not shooting something at them. But they also know that with about 8.5 million people, they don't have a real domestic market.
Yep.
So that everything that they try to commercialise has to be for a global market. What we do, I think, is we go, there's 25, 26 million of us. We're a market. Well, actually, no, we're not. Yep. And so we're all standing around the outside looking in.
Yeah,
and we all need to go 180 degrees. Let me give you a real example. So Mobileye. It's the radar sensing technology that stops your car from running into the person on the crosswalk. When that was developed at Hebrew University, they have this amazing arrangement that the academics that founded it will get 40% of it in perpetuity. So it looked like it was working. So the first thing the Israeli government said was, no one can sit for a driver's license unless they're in a car that's got Mobileye technology, and all the new cars that come in have got to have it. So even though the domestic market was tiny, they trapped it and they made that happen. I was talking to Julie from the Sugar Council before we sat down to eat, and you've got this amazing sugar industry here that's got to have to disrupt itself and change because sugary drinks aren't going to be the thing they've been and so forth. But, you know, it can make biofuel. But I don't know that there's anyone that's rushing and going, OK, how do we trap a Queensland market and what can we do to make this happen? And that's what the Israelis would do. They would just get on with it and say, this is the rule. And everyone would go, oh, yeah, OK, that makes sense. We all sit around and talk about it for about 3 weeks and then do nothing.
There's a question over here.
Thanks, Anne. Pradeep Philip from Deloitte Access Economics. It's great to have this discussion, and it seems one of the theses for this breakdown in trust is this breakdown in institutions being driven by technological change. And so it's not surprising Community Pulse people have this really negative or ambivalent view about technology. So while we're seeing technology disrupt and result in a bit of disintermediation of business models, I want the flip side of that is it's also quite empowering, however puddle deep it might be. But it forms the basis of optimism, that is, the empowerment of the individual. So I'm interested in some thoughts on what are the new institutions and incentives that allow individuals to coalesce with others and build communities for movement for the positive.
Very interesting question. Who would like to jump in on that? Because there are some interesting examples in the US and the UK and elsewhere. Kate, I reckon that one's for you. No one wants to do it.
Just an observation about tech in general, because as a sector in our trust barometer, the technology sector has always been the most trusted, about 90%. And it sat at the top of the rankings for the entire time of the trust barometer until, actually it's still at the top, but it's just declining every single time. So it's about 60% now. So that benefit of tech is, there's the issues now, it's coming. So it's the data and ethics issues, the AI, what's going to happen with the future, what's going to happen with my jobs, all those things, also fake news and what is Mark Zuckerberg doing, et cetera. All that's now causing us to be very dismayed about the tech sector and forget all the benefits it brings. But they're important things to discuss, especially data and privacy, obviously. But I think that, but your question was more about the way to empower movements, right?
Yeah.
I think that that is a really great question, and that's happening.
Well, I think we've sort of seen quite a lot of it over the summer, haven't we? People setting up, you know, platforms to find housing for people in bushfire affected communities. You know, certainly in the US.
With Them campaign and the Buy from the Bush campaign were massively successful.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think that kind of collaboration that people can do because of technology today versus in years gone by is a really good thing at the community level and for businesses and organisations writ large. The politicians, though, the problem for them is they see the other side of it, which is that it allows people to kind of almost gang up on them or through social media get directly to them. So the prism with which they see it is all of a sudden we're under siege and being attacked. So it makes them more risk averse. It almost has a counterproductive effect on them, even though it has a positive effect more generally when you're not talking about how it impacts on the pollies.
Yeah, it's interesting because I haven't thought about this a lot, as you can probably tell by the fact that I look very quizzical when Pradeep asks the question. But I reckon these institutions are going to build, they'll do the same sorts of things, but they're going to be so different. And what's going to be interesting is watching those that do like organised religions and the charitable NGOs like Red Cross and Save the Children and things like this are going to have to move into a different space because I do think there's going to be a change of the guard and it's going to be different. I watch the way my 18-year-old nephew interacts with these types of things that you would call institutions. I think universities are going to be really important.
Yeah,
they're going to look really different.
Yep.
So it is a great question. We should spend some time thinking about it.
I'm going to send you an article later.
Yeah, please do.
Question down the back.
Hi, Adrian Jones from Blocktex. Given the discussions around decarbonisation, climate change, etc., what are the panel's views on actually moving to a carbon pricing policy?
So I wasn't laughing at you.
I was like, oh, no.
I was just laughing at...
Who were you laughing at me?
I was laughing at the idea of there being a bipartisan consensus on on something like that. Look, maybe one, like dinosaurs die eventually, right? So within within one half of the political divide, there is the capacity for some of those dinosaurs to eventually, now I'm mixing my metaphors around, but be put out to pasture. And maybe when that happens, then we get there. There's been a lot of talk post the bushfires about the capacity of that kind of a way of going, but the Prime Minister's already knocked that on the head repeatedly with his rhetoric. So, you know, I'm certainly not going to hold my breath waiting for it because I'll die.
But capital markets will probably have quite a bit to do with it, one would have thought.
Yeah, but so. I mean, corporations have a carbon price. You know, anyone that makes investment decisions, Michael, you must see this at the bank and so forth, there's a, you know, always priced in, and in everyone's policies around decarbonisation, there are commitments made around how you will take a carbon price into account. So, in a way, it's sort of in a grassroots effort happening anyway, isn't it?
Did you want to comment on that, Michael?
Sure. I mean, economist's view is there should be a price on everything.
Can you ever escape the discipline? Like, do you like sign a code or something? Right. Political scientists don't have this hang-up, I've got to tell you.
My union demands it. In the end, it's the best way to allocate resources in the direction that you want. And this is starting to happen. What is kind of interesting in Australia, I think, it's not so much government leading the way. Now, for the reasons we've just heard, it's actually business that are doing
and
this,
people.
And we're just seeing this interesting shift. So you can see it in banking, for example. So I mean, it's now actually possible when you negotiate your business loan, if you agree to do certain things that will help, you know, this kind of green perspective, then you can quite often get a lower interest rate on your loan as a result.
Everybody making a note?
Coolangatta Airport's a good example of this because they've agreed to put solar panels and so on the roof, and I believe they've got a better deal than they would have done otherwise. So this is happening. And I guess what's interesting from that perspective, of course, is not only business willing to do this for a better rate, but obviously the shareholders who are lending the money are happy to take a slightly lower rate of return as well. So it tells you there is this sort of shift coming through here.
Now, innovators using Pigeonhole have been very patient. There's a question here for you, Kate. Which I think is an excellent one. Are organisations in other global markets asking different questions and seeking different strategies from Edelman than is the case in Australia?
Oh, good question.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
No, not really, I don't think. But it depends on the market if there's different policy regulations or business environment. But in general, if people are working with us to build trust or we would even, I would say, it's just actually more at the company level. So we can do discrete trust indexes, it's called our ENTS program, to look at unique company scores. And then we can even nail down to the specific drivers of trust and the actions that you need to take to build trust. So it has to happen more at the specific company level rather than being in different markets. Not too different than Australia.
Okay, very interesting. Michael, you make an interesting point, says Anonymous, about the poor condition of local government infrastructure. I think I can guess where this is coming from. What needs to change from a coordination and funding perspective?
I saw Michael earlier texting something.
I was thinking somebody from local government. I was trying to find them. What needs to change?
I mean, this is a big issue. You know, we tend to equate infrastructure as just these big projects, big metro rail systems and all the rest of it. And we tend to forget the small stuff because it's just less exciting. I mean, rebuilding a bridge out in the countryside somewhere, it doesn't offer too many opportunities to put a brass plate on it and all the rest of it. But, you know, this sort of infrastructure is just as important as driving
productivity.
Swimming
pools, very important too.
As the big picture stuff is as well. And the kind of policy bind we have ourselves into the moment is we can't do much more big picture stuff or big infrastructure because we're running at full capacity.
And particularly with the
materials, skilled labour, and so on and so on. And so what can you do? You can do either nothing, or you can...
Well, we have for the last 10 years.
Right? Well, that's why we've now got this big backlog that we need to fill in. So why not do some of these small projects in areas that are obviously pretty desperate for some help at the moment? So you're providing immediate assistance, if you like, in terms of boosting activity and jobs and so on, plus you're then kind of generating that productivity boost over the medium terms.
Yeah, and I thought your link to skills was a really interesting one too. Sorry, Kate.
I'm just going to add a funny anecdote that this reminds me of a funny collaboration between a brand and government. In America, there was a campaign last year that Domino's Pizza ran where they fixed all the potholes in their community so that they could get their pizza to their consumer faster. But they did this great government service and paid for all the potholes to be replaced and fixed in their community. So there's a great example.
Oh, my God, that's awesome.
Government working.
Maybe they'll fix their pizzas after that.
Yeah. But that was their problem, they said, because of the journey
like
and the potholes.
Of teenage girls,
I think.
Pizzas
were ruined.
Down the back, there's a question.
Pizzas in potholes.
Thanks very much, Anne. My name's Peter Hennigan, and I'm an ex public servant.
A very esteemed ex-public servant.
Yeah, mainly at the state level, but also a bit of experience with the feds. I found the Edelman stuff fascinating and obviously very interesting. You had a number of suggestions for improving trust in the political institutions. I thought there were a few others that were probably as important, if not more important, and these include things like political donations and transparency
sure.
around.
Yeah, I think that's
donations.
A really good point. Can I ask you to ask a question?
All right. Well, I mean, I just.
Do we need to focus more on integrity and accountability? Is that
well, the Independent Commissioner Against
yep.
Corruption,
yep.
A more independent public servant. I would
yep.
reflect that if I was being frank and fearless with Barnaby Joyce, I suspect I wouldn't last too long.
Well, no, you'd become the Victorian Public Service Commissioner. What do people think about the independence of... well, you would. What do people think about these other institutions, integrity and accountability frameworks, of course, which are extraordinarily strong here as opposed to some jurisdictions? How important are these things in enhancing trust? The role of the public service that we have seen, the Thodey Review completely abandoned by the government. It was a big waste of my last summer, I tell you. What do you think about those institutions as being incredibly important? We've talked about business, we've talked about some of these other ones. We haven't talked about media or these other, I think really important frameworks.
Michael wants to talk about money all the time and the money signal and so forth. And there was a first comment about political donations. I don't like them.
No.
But I don't think that we fund our political parties appropriately,
yep,
and
yep.
I don't think we pay our politicians enough. And I don't think there's a real thing that's creeping in. Executive remuneration, the tide is dropping and it very much needs to, but there are many other areas, and the way we pay people in the public service and the way we pay our politicians, for my mind, just needs complete reform. So having a system where you have a base pay and then you're reliant on activity, which brings with it an activity-based pay, to have a lunch or go to a this or whatever, forget about that. Why don't you just do your job, claim back reimbursement for the amount that you expended and get paid that, full stop, done, and have someone hindsight it.
I think someone should tweet that just as a policy recommendation. Others want to comment on it? I mean, Peter, the Senate voted down yesterday, Queensland Senator Pauline Hanson voted down the release of the Gaitchens report. I'm very disappointed about that.
Yeah, and so am I. I'm not as disappointed as I was that they even had the Gaitchens report. I didn't see the need for it.
No, we
much less
have needed that
him
here.
Being so compromised, nothing against him, but him being so compromised as being directly employed by the Prime Minister to do a report that the Prime Minister had particular interest in an outcome of. Not any suggestion of the way it was done. But the problem with these institutions, I think, is that, yeah, absolutely, we need the federal equivalent of an ICAC. However, I don't know that they necessarily, at least for a long time, enhance people's trust. I think they probably increase distrust because of what they uncover and expose and all the rest of it. So there's the catch-22 of that. I'm also a little bit uncomfortable. In an ideal world, I'm uncomfortable with constantly outsourcing political decision-making to third parties because they are the elected politicians. The only problem is that you, they're elected politicians whom you can't trust to make the decisions you'd like them to make. So you end up going for the lesser of evil of outsourcing. So the culture has to change, I think, more importantly than the institutions, because if we try too hard to change the institutions with an already corrupted culture, then you're trying to backfill it.
So it's real. Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. Okay, Kyle has been wanting to talk all day about the Queensland election. I've said no one in this room wants to talk about the Queensland election. I don't. But anyway, this is for you, Kyle. and this is a question for PVO, again, from Anonymous. Do you think there's any chance of Matt Canavan moving into Queensland state politics if the Currumbin by-election is lost and he tires of the backbench in Canberra?
I know that you asked that.
I did not. Right. I told you my private theory outside.
Apparently Dennis Atkins wrote about this, which I hadn't seen.
Did people see that in the new In Queensland publication?
Yeah. I had not seen that.
Clickbait, it's called in some...
And to be honest, I hadn't actually thought about that as a scenario, partly because I try not to think about Matt Canavan very often. But to the extent that I do think about him, I love thinking about him getting out of federal politics. So... it's an interesting concept, because I was saying at our table that he's as, let's say, maverick or radical as your George Christensen's and your Barnaby Joyce's, but he's as clean cut as your John Anderson type national, or even a Michael McCormick to some extent. So is he going to do that? I could only, he's very young. I could imagine him...
Yeah, he's 39.
..like in the concept of it, if he doesn't think that there's an easy or any pathway back into cabinet, I actually think he's likely to be coming back if Little Proud becomes leader and that's part of the compromise. Read all about it in the Weekend Australian. but short of something like that happening, I don't know that the time frame's there, is it, for him to sort of try to turn that around? And I'm now plagiarising your point, Anne, but I agree with it, so I'm happy to steal it. I'm not sure that he, as somebody who has never run for election, he's a senator, he was Barnaby Joyce's chief of staff.
Long-term political staffer and sometime economist.
He's not a guy who's actually been at that cold face of campaigning. So I could easily see them thinking he was the quick fix, but then he could become the next Campbell Newman.
Ooh. Time for one more question from the floor.
In the good and the bad from an electoral perspective.
Ooh. No, that's just stop people where they are. okay, that gives me the last question then. Actually, you know, in lots of ways, Australia's democracy may be damaged, but it has not broken. It has not broken as in other countries. And it's very interesting to think about why that is. Are there reasons for optimism and can we find it? I mean, I think the resilience of our public policy tradition that we see in the Community Pulse report were really interesting, weren't they? And I expect we'll see those again. Can you find reasons for optimism? Otherwise, you'll have to read them in the Griffith Review because you did Weekend Australian. Diane, I'm going to start with you. Are there reasons for optimism?
Look, I tried to be very optimistic, but I've said before I'm an advocate for gender equity, and I don't know that our democracy works super well when we have a parliament, three tiers of government that don't actually reflect our nation.
Yep.
And so for me, there's some major surgery that's needed somehow, but it's a partnership that needs to get sort this out. It's us as well as the institution. So I'm sorry, not too optimistic just at the minute.
Bummer. Michael?
Let's talk about the medium term.
the cycle of your next graphs.
I think there's plenty of reasons for optimism, and I say that in the sense we actually know what we need to do.
We do.
You know, we know what we need to do. We just kind of need to get on with it. And you would hope over the medium term that's exactly what will happen. And, you know, we will be certain about things once we get through this kind of current uncertainty, I think.
Kate?
I do agree. And I think what we also need is a bit of a rallying cry. I feel like we kind of lost a bit of our sense of, oh, we're Australian on the global stage. And I think that we need a bit of like, come on, Aussie, come on mentality again, where we can all rise together and be proud of what we're doing, because we are in a good spot. We don't have Trump, we don't have Brexit, we don't have crazy things like that going
on.
But we do have reason to be optimistic, but we almost need to create that big rallying cry together. And
yeah, and I thought you made that point at the end of your presentation very well. I thought you made that really interesting. So I think that's really interesting. Jared, you have to be optimistic.
Because Michael was optimistic and we're economists.
No,
and
because
and that's
you
what
have
we
to be resilient to keep working in public policy, I think.
Yeah, I always describe myself as being a measured optimist. If I go back to our last point around institutions, we haven't completely abandoned them.
No.
We have the RBA, we have the Productivity Commission, we have Royal Commissions, we do all these things. Yes, we don't always respond to them as we should, and we could activate them a lot more to give us the advice, but we still have them there. We still have great public policy thinkers, fantastic mandarins, you know. So I think you get that activated again.
Mm.
It's all sitting, it's, you know, it's kind of the infrastructure that continues to sit there, and we've just got to hit the button.
Right.
And yes, it'll take a little while to whir up,
yep.
But it'll get going again in the medium term.
Peter Van Onselen, be optimistic, please.
Oh, all this positivity and optimism. Yeah, here's some realism for you. Democracy is in peril.
Yes,
the world over, Western democracy is in peril. The fact that we're going to be the last ones to cop it in the neck doesn't make it less in peril here than elsewhere. Sure, we're doing better than the UK and the US and all the rest of it, but the institutions are crumbling. People believe in capitalism now, not democracy. Even the communists believe in capitalism. Democracy and the respect for the institutions, the practices, the checks and balances, it's gone. Half of Australians don't even believe in democracy anymore. They're turning to socialism as a genuine panacea. And it will creep up on you. Cedar, it will creep up on you. Being a little bit more measured than that, I'm not a complete crazy person. I do think that is all true, though. A new book coming out by A.C. Grayling is awesome on this, where he talks a lot about the crumbling of democracy, even though there's a continuing crafting of capitalism. He didn't say that, though. I just made that up. But I do think that's a real thing in the West.
There's some other awesome books that people can email me about that I'm about to just landed on my desk from a great essay, the one I'm going to send you, Pradeep, that's really worth reading. So one of the things I think that we really need to be glad about is the quality of some of the journalism that we're seeing in response to some of these developments. So I'm not as pessimistic as you. Ladies and gentlemen, I think that's been... I see it, Nia. I think that's been a really fascinating discussion. Thank you for your questions, both from the floor and on the pigeonhole. Can you please join me in thanking Diane Smith-Gander, Peter Van Onselen, Jared Ball, Kate Ferguson and Michael Bly?